In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed
6:36 on Seattle's Morning News. Colleen O'Brien, Travis Mayfield, Aaron Granillo, Chris Sullivan. And now Felix Bunnell. Have we ever had a studio this full before?
Can I borrow your chair?
Wow.
Standing room only.
Surprised you have a microphone, man. That's our resident historian, Felix Bunnell. He joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map. It's a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, as World War II was still raging, a national campaign was launched in 1944 to build living memorials in communities around the country. And people in Washington definitely joined in.
Yeah, I want to thank researcher Lee Corbin for unearthing some fascinating materials the past few days about the American Commission for Living War Memorials and their impact here in Washington. This was a national movement to memorialize World War II in a way that was a break from the past, an embrace of a kind of a new modernity. The idea was that instead of building statues or merely decorative monuments, like they'd done with the Civil War and World War I with all those generals on horseback and those doughboys, the idea was to instead build swimming pools, community centers, playfields, highways, and things like stadiums. They called these more practical monuments living memorials. Now, this was a big debate between traditionalists who favored those doughboys and other statues and urban planners who were looking ahead to the big changes that were coming during and after World War II. And this debate about those traditional memorials and the versus the living memorials, it wasn't just some academic exercise being fought by scholars and professors or writers for esoteric architecture journals. This argument was taking place in the pages of really mainstream popular magazines like Good Housekeeping and Better Home and Gardens. People were talking about this everywhere. And now this group, the American Commission for Living War Memorials, they published a booklet in 1944 with lists of ideas and photos of different kinds of facilities that communities could choose to build. So it wasn't only about remembering the war dead. An equal part was about physical fitness of future generations. Things like making sure everyone learned how to swim, because they said so many deaths in World War II of soldiers and sailors were because guys weren't healthy enough. They didn't know how to swim, or they couldn't swim for more than a couple minutes. There were all these drownings in the early years of World War II. Now, the chairman of the West Coast chapter of this group was a radio broadcaster from California named Sam Hayes. These radio people are always causing trouble in local communities. Now, he visited Washington in May 1945. He gave big speeches to community gatherings in Seattle, Spokane, Tacoma, Everett, Bellingham, Bremerton, Olympia. News clippings from around that time described fundraising efforts underway for a memorial pool in Everett and a stadium at Highline High School in Burien. Now, it's unclear so far where Seattle High School Memorial Stadium fits into this national movement. And that's why we're doing the story this week, because there's all the plans to tear that down and replace it with something new. Planning for that old stadium was underway before the war had even ended. But an expert on the Living Memorial Movement wrote in an article, this was all true. This is true all over the country. And it was weird compared with earlier times where they'd waited for the war to be over before they talked about memorials. People were just chomping at the bit. World War II was so much about the world modernizing, all that new technology, all those people on the move and everything. And there was so much change underway during World War II. By a certain point, victory was in sight, and so it made sense to start talking about what was going to happen next. And that fits right in with wanting to build practical, usable facilities that everyone could enjoy rather than just a bunch of statues standing around in parks. Now, I've only been able to identify a couple other examples that are still standing in here in the state. One is the stadium in Port Townsend, which has like a war memorial right out front. It was built in 1948, and there's a pool in Walla Walla. It might have been replaced, but I think it's originally a World War II memorial pool. I'd love to hear from our listeners if there's other examples out around the state that I haven't heard about. And I think part of the deal, these living memorials were too successful. I mean, people, they forgot they were memorials. They were so good at just like attracting people to exercise and do stuff that you didn't think about the doughboy statue. You just thought about the football game.
So that's more obvious.
And that's why I think Memorial Stadium is sort of on the cusp of being demolished for good. This war memorial built with all these good intentions during World War II. Set to be raised, to be replaced with something totally modern and not connected to its past.
All right. If you can help Felix, our state roofing text line is 888-973-5476, 888-973-CHIRO. Felix, thank you.
Thanks.
It's time to talk with Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. She has an important senator on this Sunday who just got done grilling the head of the TikTok CEO. Here's what she plans to say to him.
Well, this hearing that happened yesterday before the House Energy Committee was pretty darn tense. And the CEO of TikTok really did take fire from Democrats and Republicans in a really intense grilling over 5 hours. It's not clear that he changed any minds or that he needs to, frankly, by playing to a public, as he reminded people, where 150 million Americans still use the app, despite all this concern about China being able to exploit Chinese company ByteDance, which owns TikTok. This is really becoming a snapshot of this geopolitical standoff between Beijing and Washington, these two economic powers who are fighting it out for dominance in the technology space. Senator Mark Warner will join me Sunday. He's very concerned and has been about this. He's got a bill the White House has endorsed that would either give President Biden the option to ban the app or to force the sale of it.
But it also strikes the issue of popularity. I mean, this is an app that is so used by, basically, if you're 35 and younger, you have this and you use it obsessively. If they were to ban this, I can't even imagine the reaction in this country.
Well, it goes to that option then, right? Of is the job in the hands of lawmakers or is it in Silicon Valley and the hope that somebody builds a better mousetrap, a more competitive version of TikTok that doesn't have these national security concerns attached to it. You know, social media companies are scrutinized for collecting data on users. The question here with TikTok is the ownership of a Chinese entity, ByteDance, and the fact that the Department of Justice is investigating surveillance of an American journalist by employees of ByteDance. They no longer work at the company, but two of whom were based in China, who access location data of that journalist and other information. The Department of Justice is investigating this. So it has been shown that this can be done in terms of Beijing accessing information of Americans here and what they're doing. And the question is whether this is done on a mass scale.
Speaking of China, I feel like for a while we were obsessed with these white balloons, and now I don't see any headlines about them. Whatever came of that?
That's a good question. You know, it was up to the FBI, because this happened on U.S. soil, to examine the hardware attached to that downed Chinese spy balloon. And we haven't heard an update recently, you're right, on what was learned about what risk level this posed. But it really is just one of the many data points in this growing geopolitical tension between China and the United States. There is no more important relationship, threatening relationship, or top security issue when it comes to President Biden and his administration right now. They continuously say that, but exactly how to deal with an increasingly adversarial Beijing is incredibly complicated on so many different levels because of how intertwined financially, technologically, and economically our two countries are. So we have seen a sort of lowering of the temperature when it comes to the spy balloon. You're not hearing the administration talk about it much, you're right. That may be deliberate in an attempt to cool things off. President Xi and President Biden still have not spoken by phone since that incident happened.
Margaret Brennan, Face the Nation moderator, CBS News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent. Thank you this morning.
Thank you.
It is 7:15 on a Friday morning. A lot going on in Olympia. We're keeping track of a $70 billion situation when it comes to the budget, tax dollars. The question is, can lawmakers do a deal for a budget, or are we talking about a special session? Also, is the governor running or not for a fourth term? And Matt Markovich is here to talk about both of those things. But Matt, I want to start because the state Supreme Court this morning expected to issue its ruling on that really controversial capital gains tax. Where do things stand? What are we watching?
Well, we're watching it very closely. We don't know when the ruling will come out. It'll come out sometime this morning. And the lawmakers, which are right across the street, basically, from the Supreme Court, are going to be watching it really closely because it involves the budget, which they're talking about right now, about the money. So basically, this capital gains tax that people are saying, or an excise tax, this was a measure that passed in 2021. It's 7% tax on the sale of stocks and bonds and other high-end assets over the excess of $250,000. So this tax took effect the beginning of last year, and the first payments, coincidentally, are due April 18th. Familiar day. That's the federal tax day. And that's what people are saying. This, if you're implementing, putting this as a income tax, you know, on April 18th, that's what we're associating income taxes with. An excise tax, if you ever bought a pair of tires, you'll know that there's an excise tax that happens at the time of when the purchase is made. So when the tax is paid is a big, big deal in this case. Now, basically, in March of 2022, a judge ruled that the capital gains excise tax does not meet constitutional requirements and therefore is unconstitutional, invalid. So the state appealed, and while they have been appealing, they still have been collecting this tax. There was an online system collecting this tax for people who wanted to pay it before the April 18th date. And so now we're going to find out whether or not this is a legitimate tax. Now, it generates the in these budgets that are coming out now with the House and the Senate, they're relying on this tax. It's projected to bring in $415 million this year, the first year that the state will see this tax. So they're already baking it into the cookie here. These budgets are coming out. The Senate just came out with its brand new operating budget, $70 billion yesterday. There's no new taxes in it or fees, but it does rely on money from the capital gains tax.
That seems dangerous to rely on that when the constitutionality is up in the air. What does your gut tell you about the Supreme Court? You've been covering this story from the start.
Well, it's a very liberal court. And so there could be a ruling that it is considered an excise tax. If it does, that changes the entire structure of all these taxes that a lot of the Democrats are trying to propose going forward. A wealth tax, various other kind of taxes that some people say is disguised as an income tax, but it's been going to be called an excise tax. It's going to change that. And the thing is about taxes in Washington, it has to be uniform. You know, when you go to one county and buy something, the sales, you're always going to get a sales tax. It may change it a little bit, but it's even. This is a tax that's only taxing really people who make a lot of money, over $250,000 in assets, and people are saying that's an uneven tax. That's not a property tax. It has to be evenly distributed. So it's a huge, huge ruling for everybody who pays taxes, as well as the lawmakers who are, like you said, Colleen, baking these in their budget. And again, it's budget season. They just came out with that. The Senate just basically put in $3 billion for schools, which is a lot of people are saying that's really good. $679 million for clean energy projects. The budget directs $115 million to assist prosecutors and judges dealing with the backlog of resentencings for the Blake decision. That's that simple possession of drugs that was determined unconstitutional by the same court. And there's a $55 million for opioid treatments for, we've been talking about that drug possession law, you know, that you have to go to a treatment center instead of going to jail. Well, they've put aside $55 million for those treatment centers.
I see $679 million for clean energy projects, $2.9 billion for learning and school, right. Which fine. Only $55 million when the opioid crisis is ongoing and really just ramping up with fentanyl?
Well,
that seems enough.
There's actually more money for behavioral health and issues like that. This is one specifically line item for treatment programs and services tied to that drug possession law.
Okay.
So yeah, arguably, is that enough? I think a lot of people say absolutely not. But I do want to play one thing here. You know, yesterday we had an opportunity to talk to the governor because this tax forecast, and a tax forecast came out, and he was hoping that maybe he wouldn't have to put this $4 billion housing levy to the vote of the people if the money was going to be better for the taxes. Well, it really wasn't. So then I asked him yesterday if he has a plan B for his $4 billion plan.
Just in terms of your $4 billion plan, do you have a plan B now that the revenue forecast came out and in the next two bienniums is going to be down lower than what the forecast was? And you had been talking about a method of not having a levy go to the public vote. What do you see from that forecast, and do you believe the levy will go to the public vote, or do you have a plan B?
I believe this would be widely accepted by the public, and there's good polling on this that we can share with you to show that, you know, by large, large majorities, the public believes we have a housing crisis, and they believe this is a realistic approach. So I'm very confident it would pass.
And there he said, that's his company. He thinks it'll pass. I asked the governor's office for that polling data. They have yet to get it to me.
Of course.
So I can't share that. I was hoping to share that with you.
Maybe he's listening. He's often shaving as he listens to our show in the morning. He's been known to call in spontaneously. Now, one last question before we have to leave you, Matt. You asked him if he'll run again. So can I play that for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Here's what he said.
Fourth term.
I got to ask you for your advice. Until I get advice from this group, you just never know. I got some advice from the Seattle Times.
Well, it's a candidate. It's a rumored candidate backed out, or he said, we're not going to run. Do they know something that we don't from you?
No, they don't. I'm focused on what we're doing. We'll make the decision at the right moment, and it'll be the right decision.
I guess we'll wait and see then. Matt Markovich, thank you very much. Keep us posted on that ruling from the state Supreme Court as well.
Will do.
And your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Robert W. Baird. As some of you may know, as I've talked about on air, I started the daily dose of kindness for Travis's son, Tommy, who passed away. And today I'm dedicating this story to Sawyer, Tessa, and Jack, as Tessa is a dear friend of mine, too. And I want to let her know that just like Tommy, Sawyer, with his beautiful long eyelashes and that glowing, cheeky smile, Sawyer will never be forgotten. His name is Herman Cruz. He's a beloved school bus driver, and he's so much more. He takes time to help the students he drives to Middle Township Elementary School in New Jersey learn how to read.
I can fly.
Can you?
No.
He tells the Today Show his efforts were born as a way to lend a hand when he wasn't working.
It started as a means of killing time until dismissal. I overheard a student interacting with his teacher about a reading assignment and that he didn't get it done. And I said, you know what? I can help him. He just was exuberant. It started with one, and then it just got contagious.
Oh, my goodness. Calm down. Calm down.
2 years later, he meets 3 days a week with kindergartners, first and second graders, one-on-one for hours at a time at the school. They now start to call his reading program Mr. Herman's Kids.
When Mr. Herman comes to my class, I smile. I want to be smart like him.
He helps me learn new words.
He is my best friend ever.
Since he's given so much to the school and the kids, they decided recently to give something back to him. He thought he was getting set to get on his bus for the drive home, but instead found students waiting for him outside the school to cheer him on and thank him for his work.
Y'all, do we love Mr. Herman?
Yeah!
He was presented with a plaque that says Mr. Herman's Kids Corner, and now he has an official area in the school for his reading program. And Scholastic heard about it, donated 1,000 books to the school in Mr. Herman's honor.
Mr. Herman.
Yes.
I love it.
School bus drivers are heroes.
Indeed they are. Mr. Herman's a hero.
Yes. And now it's 7:48. G. Scott from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays at 9 to noon here on Cairo News Radio. G, looking good in that, what do you call it, Letterman's jacket for the Seahawks?
Letterman's jacket,
is
no doubt about it.
It's
no.
Crisp.
I've had it.
It's crispy.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the Zags?
I want to talk about the Zags all day today.
Yes. Yes. Me too. Me too. Me too. Me too.
No. But okay. Yes. We all saw it. We saw them down 13 yesterday in the first half. We saw them come in the second half, completely just become aggressive, play great defense. We saw Timmy could do anything that he wanted
Timmy.
Last night, and we saw them down. Were they down two or down one? Excuse me, down one, 10 seconds left. They come down. You're like, oh, okay, what kind of play is this going to be? I said, whoa, the dude shoots it from dang near
insane.
Half court. And
yeah.
I mean, he when he shot it,
yeah.
Yep.
Hold your breath.
Yeah. I've been watching that clip over and over and over. That's the stuff of movies.
Can I bore you guys to death with something? Can
I tell you, I don't think we like boring content
like
on the show.
I don't think you could bore anybody. Let's hear it.
So, I sat there, and because, as you know, sometimes when I'm not working doing radio, I go and I do public speaking, and I go speak to companies and all that. I wrote a thing last night based on Gonzaga. Let me tell you, winning culture that they have established over the years is why we continue to see what we see out of them.
Yeah.
Let me explain. When they're down 13, they're down 13 in the first half. I'm sure they go into halftime. Now, they're getting ready to go into the second half. Now, a lot of teams, when you're down like that, you have this thought of, oh, I hope we can win. Or some have this thought of, maybe we can win. The Zags have a winning culture.
Yeah.
And a winning culture that says, we're winning.
We will.
We will win.
Yeah.
And the same thing, I'm telling you, sports is a microcosm to life. The same thing that you see out of the Zags, that's life, baby. Yeah. Right? You yeah. get knocked down. You're down. You have a bad day. You have a bad week. You don't, oh, I hope. Don't stop hoping.
Yeah.
Ain't no hoping.
It's like radio, too. Think about you and Ursula and Chef and Nick. You know you're going to have a good show. We yeah. will have a good show.
Right.
Doesn't matter. You have to have a team around you and a culture that says positivity, winning, and I don't know, success. Is that the next
winning? Like it just yeah. the success is in the journey. So a lot, sometimes the knock, right? They try to put a knock on. Yeah, the Zags
yes.
win, but
yes,
and
yes,
and the yeah, but is they haven't won the championship.
Yes.
But what you don't understand is here's the real yeah, but. They have been winning for years.
Yes. Since 1999.
You can't talk NCAA tournament yes. and not talk about the Zags.
Can they please get the name right, though? They've been in that tournament since 1999. And yet the network commentators still call it Gonzaga. Can't stand it. They should be fined.
Yeah. I like it.
But hey, either way, they're saying a name.
Yeah, that's true.
They're trying.
True.
You know what I mean?
Aaron, you came in all fired up about this.
I was
this
fired
morning.
Up. Gee, when you watched that shot leave Strother's hands, be honest though. You're like, what are you doing?
That's exactly what I said.
Yeah.
It's funny you bring that up. Because when I was writing my stuff, I'm seriously gonna do a talk behind this.
Yeah.
That's life, right?
Yeah.
Because
right.
people on the outside,
yes.
they say, gee, mm-hmm. what are you doing going to clean cars for the Seattle Seahawks, huh? What are you doing trying this? I can't believe you got out of the relationship. What are you doing? Everybody on the outside is like, what are you doing? And the person that takes the shot
yeah.
say, don't worry about me.
Mm-hmm.
Worry about you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make this shot.
Yeah.
And when he made it, he just stood there and stared at it like,
because it wasn't hope. It's like you said. He knew that shot was going in.
He knew.
Yeah.
And not only did he know, I want to talk about this next part of it, though. This is where it gets real deep. He asked his coach, hey, coach, mm-hmm. if I got that shot right there from three, do I take it? Mark Few say, yeah, mm-hmm. take it.
Coach.
So
yeah.
sometimes in your life, you sometimes need, y'all ready for this? You need that partner,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or you need that person in your life to tell you, take the shot. Oh, y'all got me going to church this morning.
No, I feel like I'm going to church. I almost shouted, hallelujah.
Like this is the stuff that the Zags did that for me, right? They did that for me. And I knew that they were going to win yesterday.
We just went to the church at
Even
G-Scott.
When they were down? Even when they were down?
Because it's the Zags,
Aaron.
Man.
That's such okay. an Aaron comment.
I'm just saying.
No,
Aaron,
no, the newsman
over
skeptic.
Here.
Because,
I'm just saying.
You know,
I had my doubts. Not going to lie.
True newsman right there.
Hey, there's a pro team in town that has had winning culture for the last 13 years.
You're so rocking them on your jacket.
The Seahawks have done the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? Right? The same thing. Oh, my goodness. Last year, Geno Smith. Oh, he was a Pro Bowler. Comeback Player of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways.
Jeez.
Shout out to the Zags.
I loved that. I feel
Amen.
The spirit.
Yeah.
I
Amen.
Got goosebumps. Right.
Did I bore you enough?
No, that was not boring.
Okay, see you guys.
I feel inspired now.
All right, now back to this breaking news coming to us from Olympia from the Washington State Supreme Court. The court there ruling 7-2 to uphold this tax that basically would tax some of the richest folks in Washington State. Matt Markovich has been tracking this for us. So, Matt, what you've been able to kind of parse through here, what are you learning as you're looking at all of this?
I like what the Supreme Court said really early off in its ruling here, that Washington State is an unusual state when it comes to taxation because we don't have an income tax. It's constitutionally illegal to have an income tax. So basically, this is basically supporting what Democrats have wanted for a long time, that there can be an excise tax on income, which can be declared property. But the court basically determined that this capital gains is not an income tax, and it's an excise tax. It's not property, which is a big deal in the state. Income has been declared as property and can be taxed like property and has to be uniform, but by the Supreme Court basically saying it's not property, not income, therefore not property. It's an excise tax, therefore it can be constitutional. And that's the big part about all this, is that the bigger scheme about this is, as we just talked about a little bit earlier, how it affects us even right now is that the lawmakers across the street in the legislature are basically probably doing high fives right now, that they now have another $400 million to spend from this capital gains tax that's been sitting in limbo, and it's been, they've been collecting this tax for quite a while.
And Matt, I just wanted to ask, because I know there's this huge social movement right now to tax the rich. They need to pay their fair share of taxes, and it sounds like this excise or capital gains tax is doing that. So what exactly is the dissent with this specific tax?
Well, it does. There's a set. I haven't read the entire ruling on why there were two justices that opposed this ruling. I have not read their dissent just yet. But what this means is that things like the wealth tax, which is right now before the state legislature, so basically a similar tax, a 7% on the wealthiest people who earn $250 million off assets like bonds and stocks, that could go forward. Just 2 days ago, Speaker Jenkins says, that probably won't go through this particular session, because basically they're waiting on what the court would decide. Now the court has decided. Literally, that tax can go right in front of the lawmakers today, and then may move forward through this session. So a whole nother excise tax on the rich. So you're correct, Colleen, there is this movement to tax the uber wealthy in this state. This really green lights that tax as an excise tax. And then I can't explain even, I can't, this is really a huge decision on the taxation prospect, on the field of taxation in the state of Washington.
Matt, let me say to get a little bit on the dissent here. And the concern is that, as we have seen in Washington throughout the years, the way that the Democrats have used, you know, in power, used the taxing arm, is the concern that this will not be a tax on the uber wealthy in 10 years. There's a concern that, oh, we got it at this threshold, then we get into a revenue forecast where it's bad. They can lower it and lower it and lower it. Next thing you know, everybody is paying it.
I mean, so yeah, that, and you that's, can, you and can that's forecast 30 years
right,
into the,
but that's
and
what the,
make
that's
up
the
any
history.
Worst case scenario.
No, that's not the worst case. That's the history of taxing in our state. So, and I'm just telling you, that's what the concern is. Also, people have asked me about this question, too. What are they doing their income taxes? Because even though the state Supreme Court rules this, the IRS says, no, this is an income tax. Some people I see are going to file their taxes and say no if they follow this, because the IRS doesn't see this as at least they, as because they filed briefs in the court to that effect.
Which makes me wonder, is there a U.S. Supreme Court case here if people start doing that? I mean, because obviously we think about this as the state Supreme Court being the final word here. They move forward. But if taxpayers in Washington start filing their federal taxes in this manner, that seems like it then becomes a federal issue.
Well, it's a transactional thing. This is why I have to understand what an excise tax is versus what a property tax is or an income tax is. When you sell bonds, there's a transaction there. What they're basically saying now, the court is saying, okay, we're going to put a 7% tax on the sale of these bonds if it's over $250,000. It's almost like a sales tax. It's a transactional thing. Now, people have argued that, well, if you made money off your stock and bonds, basically that's what capital gains is, that's property, that's income, and you can't tax income in the state. It's constitutionally illegal. So that's the important part about it. I'm trying to oversimplify so people can understand.
Yeah.
Think of it as a transitional sales tax. When you sell a bond or you sell a house, in a way, you're making some money off that. That's a transaction. It's not income, like it's you earn income over a whole year, and at the end of the year you're taxed like it 15% on all your income. I'm trying to help you understand how important this tax is,
the difference between this capital gains and an income. So income being what you work for at a job or an independent, you know, freelancer, versus having assets like a house, like stocks and bonds,
and previous
generational
court
wealth, if you
will. And previous court rulings have ruled income as property, and then if you're going to tax property in Washington State, it has to be uniformly. It has to be across the wide. It's 10% on everybody, kind of a thing.
There's only a handful of these rich, uber rich folks that this is going to. 400, Sully says. So my question: have any?
No,
of
that's a different.
A different
wealth
tax.
Okay.
Sorry,
okay.
But that's still, the wealth tax. Number they were looking. That's the wealth tax. My apologies.
But it's a small number of folks who this applies
no,
to.
No, not at all.
Okay,
no.
So let's tell us this.
No. So this is anybody who makes $250,000. First $250,000 you make on the sale of assets, like stocks, bonds,
homes.
This property. Does not apply to homes, though.
No, it doesn't apply to homes.
No, it does not. Yeah, because then it would attack. It would not attack. It would tax a lot more people than what they're going for.
So
it affects a lot of people. There's a lot of people that this affects. I mean, think about it. That's $413 million this year. So that's a lot of money. That's a lot of people paying into this tax. So it's not just the uber wealthy tax. That's the wealth tax. That's for the super rich. This does affect common people, obviously not low income people who don't have that kind of money to spend on stocks and bonds and make $250,000 every year. So just think of it after $250,000 on everything you sell except for your house, you're going to have to pay a 7% tax on it.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about the dissent, so we're going to let you go, Matt, and you can chew through that, maybe join the show or the newscast later on to give us more on that. It was a 7-2 ruling by the Washington State Supreme Court upholding the state's capital gains tax. That's given the Democrats that big win they were pushing for in that just coming out in the last 20 minutes. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome.
The United States has carried out a retaliatory strike in Syria after a drone attack killed a U.S. contractor. Five American soldiers and another contractor also hurt in that. We're joined by Face the Nation's Margaret Brennan to ask about what happened.
Well, according to the Pentagon and Central Command in the Middle East, this strike killed an American contractor and wounded a number of Americans, American service people, and another American contractor. And it was carried out by a drone of Iranian origin, is how the Secretary of Defense described it. It was carried out in eastern Syria, where there are roughly 900 U.S. troops as part of the campaign against ISIS. Iran, which has proxy forces in Syria, doesn't want those U.S. forces to be there. And so we often see this volley back and forth of fire or strikes between the U.S. And these Iranian proxy forces. But this caused an American fatality. And so it drew a U.S. response, which CENTCOM announced. Again, now we see another barrage of rockets that just happened this morning, early Friday. So at this point, the Pentagon is saying there have not been more U.S. casualties, but this certainly is something that seems to be a live issue. We're tracking it.
You will also have a guest on this Sunday to speak on the banking crisis. If I can still call it that, seems like everything's calmed down a bit in that sector.
Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
That's the big question. Is it over? And how stable is the banking sector, given the failure of this California and New York-based bank that we saw in recent weeks, and then concerns about some of the larger ones. The Federal Reserve went ahead with its interest rate hike up a quarter of a percentage point this week, indicating that they think they can continue to try to tighten up things to try to lower inflation, but also indicated the banking crisis may be doing some of the work for them because it's tightening up credit, meaning it's going to be harder to get loans. It's going to slow down some activity potentially. So then that raises the question of, does that trigger a recession, more severe one? What's the likelihood? What is happening out there? How did the Federal Reserve miss the risk to the system when it comes to the banks itself? A lot of questions for Neil Kashkari, who will be my guest on Sunday on Face the Nation. He is president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, but you may remember the name from back in 2008 when he was part of the Treasury Department's response. He created that TARP program that helps stabilize the biggest banks in the country. Now we're talking about these mid-sized banks who are seeing the problems. We want to talk to him about that perspective. Where are we?
Margaret Brennan, Face the Nation moderator, CBS News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent. Thank you this morning.
Thank you.
C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for
the Girl
cookie.
Scouts cookie season is wrapping up. Speaking of profits, my goodness.
Yeah.
Did you buy some?
We have some in our cupboard. My husband bought some.
What's your cookie?
Thin mints.
Yeah.
Yeah, thin mints.
I'm a Samoa girl.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, Samoas are good.
But you can, Aaron Granillo.
All about them.
Yeah, Samoas are the bomb. But, you know, I can't pass up thin mints either. My oldest daughter just finished up her cookie season, and I'm so proud of her troop. They sold about, speaking of profits, $27,000 worth of cookies.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's an incredible accomplishment for 9 and 10-year-olds. And then I come across an article. A Girl Scout from Bainbridge Island is taking the entire organization by protesting and not selling Girl Scout cookies because of one ingredient, palm oil. This is 17-year-old Simone McGrath.
Girl Scout cookies have been formulated with palm oil since 2006. And unfortunately, our actions are hurting people on the other side of the globe. The palm oil business is risking the health and liberty of palm workers. That could include lack of sanitation, latrines or clean water, passport apprehension, other coercion, and exposure to dangerous insecticides.
I've heard about this movement of palm oil, and then it surprised me that it was coming up in Girl Scouts cookies, specifically because my daughter just had her first sales, and I thought, do I need to know about this? She pointed out to me that the Girl Scouts do well enough with cookie sales to make the change to its cookie formula, but...
I am not the first Girl Scout to bring this issue up. Others, such as Rihanna Tumpishan, Madison Borva, Olivia Chaffin, Sophia Hammond... but I do hope to be the last. I haven't heard anything from Girl Scouts, GSUSA, to me specifically, but I hope that changes.
Well, I reached out to the Girl Scouts because they hadn't gotten back to Simone, and they did write me back. They gave me a little statement about the use of palm oil and the human rights violations that palm oil farms are accused of and all of that. And here's what it says in part. Girl Scouts aim to build youth of courage, confidence, and character who make the world a better place. We applaud Simone for embodying these core values and for standing up to advocate for an issue they are passionate about. Girl Scouts of USA and Girl Scouts of Western Washington share this passion and are committed to the use of sustainable, ethical practices that protect the environment and safeguard human rights, which is why we are members of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. Our goal is to achieve 100% RSPO, that's the Roundtable of Sustainable Palm Oil, products for all Girl Scout cookies. And to that, Simone says,
that's a Herculean task, as most suppliers rely on a tangled web. So it's very difficult to monitor.
She said it's not as simple as just saying we want to do this. It's a tangled web. It's hard to undo the palm oil industry. Another part of the Girl Scout statement says few alternatives exist. So almost agreeing with Simone that, yeah, like palm oil is the ingredient. It's all over the food industry. It's very difficult. There are really no viable and readily available products, the Girl Scouts say, to do this. Well, it turns out Simone has a solution to that, too. Remember the name Mackenzie Scott? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ex-wife of Jeff Bezos. Yeah. She's a newly minted solo billionaire thanks to helping him build that company. She's been donating like crazy and gave $84 million to the Girl Scouts recently. With that, Simone wants to see...
Our founding principles, our pledge, and our founder both advocate for environmental ownership and appreciation. And philanthropist Mackenzie Scott donated $84.5 million recently. It presents a terrific opportunity that could go to altering the cookie program.
She says use that $84 million to come up with a new recipe. Untangle from the palm oil industry. So thank you, Simone, for joining us for that interview. You can read her article on palm oil and her fight against using it in Girl Scout cookies in Miss Magazine.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.